Say something.
This is Chef Brandon Howland. Today we are talking with Vin about terpenes and cooking, and we're going to talk about cannabis, the most important thing. Does that sound good?
Yeah, it seems a little low. Mine's high, so because I'm going to turn mine down then. So I'm not overpowering yours. Say something again just for a sec.
This is Chef Brandon Allen here for a radio interview to talk about cannabis and terpenes and cooking and organic versus non-organic and cannabis quality and interpreting.
Okay,
and all
we're good.
That jazz.
Yeah, we're good. I think the levels are pretty close now.
Sounds good.
So I'm going to start recording. And I'm going to turn off airtime. Good afternoon, KW. This is Vin Maru from CKMS 102.7. This is the Talking Cannabis Radio Show, and today I have a special guest on. It was a gentleman I met last year at two different conferences, one in LA and one in Prague, which was very exciting to be at. And I really got to have great conversations with him, respected his knowledge on terpenes, as well as evaluating cannabis, going through with microscopes, testing it out. He'll explain a bit of his background and why I respect his opinions. But his name is Brandon Allen, and he, I would consider, is one of the foremost experts in identifying terpenes and I'll let him talk about that. Brandon, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Vin. It's good to be connected with you again, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really great to connect again, and I look forward to conversations in the future. But today, I really wanted to get into talking about organic cannabis, terpenes, all of this, because here's what I see happening in the industry. And, this is a bit from the Canadian perspective, because we've legalized and we've got these big corporations growing and selling and whatnot, finding out that the quality is just not there. It's not dried properly. Lots of complaints, lots of returns. The fact that they say there's no supply in the retail store doesn't mean much, because the supply from the producers is just such low quality that they're not even bringing it out there. So what does get to the retail stores obviously gets gobbled up pretty quickly. So I've been involved in the cannabis industry for 5 years now and have learned a lot over the years. And I can honestly say, after having tried organic cannabis myself, and that's something I just recently grew myself under my own medical license, I notice a difference right away. Now, in the past, cannabis consumers, a lot of people are doing hydroponic. There's different grow methods, different nutrients. So it's all over the board. There's no consistency. So I want you to talk about your background, how you evaluate cannabis, and your background in evaluating cannabis, because that's exciting to talk about in itself. But do you, having the experience that you have, do you notice a difference between the types of cannabis in terms of terpenes, smells, potency, all of that under various different grow methods, but also with kind of the organic nature to it? So please, share with us why I've actually come to respect you, but also, your thoughts on organic and synthetic cannabis.
Sure. So I think the very first thing I'll say is, regardless of whether something is organically grown indoors, organically grown outdoors, whether it's a greenhouse, it doesn't really matter what the light spectrum is. At the end of the day, the most important thing to me is going to be the quality and making sure that it's safe to consume. Now, I have experienced cannabis all across the spectrum, from outdoor, regenerative farming, biodynamic, sustainable farming practices, organic as it can possibly get, flower that's been great and also has been bad. And on the other side of the spectrum, the overloaded nutrient that just so happened to be flushed properly, and there's nothing organic about it, I've had really great and I've had really poor quality as well. So in the sense of simplifying something and just saying, oh, it's organic, it's better, that is a bandwagon that I will never jump on because I've seen this spectrum and the variances within it. So to kind of get from there is just to kind of explain how I got into wanting to even know the difference in quality. It all stems from me being a chef. So I won the first ever High Times Top Cannabis Chef Cook-Off almost 2 years ago. It was actually 420 weekend 2 years ago through High Times, and that was an amazing experience. That's kind of what opened up the door for me to get into the cannabis industry. But it was about 6 months or so before that when I moved to California and I started consuming cannabis on a regular basis as a medicine, not just as a recreational or adult use type of thing, just having fun with friends and taking a load off at the end of the day. And when I started consuming it, I wanted to focus on the edible side because of the fact that I used to smoke cigarettes way too long and way too many. And I didn't want to go down the smoking route because I wasn't sure how that would affect me. So I started kind of more or less microdosing 5 to 10 milligrams at a time, which, you know, did certainly make me feel high because my tolerance was low at that time. And I started experiencing a lot of benefits with my severe chronic back pain that I've had since I've been about 9 years old. And I also do a ketogenic diet primarily, and I was kind of at a little plateau, and I noticed that when I started consuming cannabis that my weight loss, the journey that I was on, actually started to speed up, and I got over that plateau. So I experienced better sleep, better pain management, weight loss, just overall my quality of life definitely took a few steps forward. And as I was eating these edibles that I was buying from dispensaries, I realized that I really didn't trust the ingredients that were in there, and a lot of them didn't fall into my ketogenic or low carb lifestyle. So I wanted to start cooking and making my own infusion. So I started buying flour and making different tinctures, and I was making oils and all these different things. And I finally realized one day I'm standing at the dispensary and I have all these different options in front of me. And if I were to ask the bud tender or consultant, whatever you like to call them, what the difference in quality is, the only thing that they would tell me is the THC percentage. Oh, well, this one's 20% and this one's 30%. I was like, well, that really doesn't mean much to me because I can go to, you know, look at different ground beef and I can see, well, this is 15% fat and this one's 15% fat, but this one's who knows where it came from, conventional, super factory farmed, and this one over here is organic, pasture raised, grass-fed cows. So even though the fat content's the same, I know that there's a difference in quality. So I started doing some research on cannabis quality, and I came across the Trichome Institute. And Trichome Institute created a program called Interpening. So think of it as interpreting terpenes. And I became an interpreter. So I got certified through their course, and fast forward a couple years later, I'm actually partnered up with Trichome Institute now and have helped them completely redevelop their curriculum, and we have a lot of great things which we can talk about later on. But what really got me into understanding quality was the fact, like I said before, that I'm a chef. So I can look at a marble, my steak that's marbled nicely or another one that's not, and I can tell the difference. I can smell what pungent, fresh cilantro should be like versus, you know, crappy cilantro. I know the difference between a ripe tomato and an unripe tomato, but I didn't know how to identify quality with cannabis. So the interpreting thing was that research was completely inspired by becoming or by being a chef in the first place and just wanting to be working with the highest quality ingredients I could get my hands on. So that's always been my primary focus. Is quality, quality, quality. I want to make sure that I'm not consuming product that's covered in mold or mildew or that has spider mites or fungus gnats are all stuck in it, or just even in the things that might not be harmful. I want to make sure that the level of quality is there. You know, there's a spectrum from acceptable to highest, and I want to make sure that I'm doing my best to consume the highest, and that's what the interpreting methodology taught me. When we get into understanding the difference between organic and non-organic, obviously the chef in me, as well as the purist in me, wants to be able to work with the flower that's been just simplified. Just let it grow, give it good soil, give it the proper lighting that it needs, and ideally the sun if that's possible. And I think that that's like all fine and dandy, and in a perfect world it sounds awesome. But then there's kind of the realist side of me that looks at things as there's supply and demand. And unfortunately, Humboldt County and other regions of the world, they can't grow outdoor cannabis year-round. And they also can't guarantee that their outdoor cannabis is going to be of quality because of various things that could happen with the weather, with frost, late frost, with terrible rain and different things like that. And it's not like with wine where it's like, oh, it was a rainy season and we had a forest fire in the distance and we got a beautiful amount of botrytis for our this year's vintage, and it's fantastic. With cannabis, you know, when you start to get mold and mildew and unacceptable environmental stressors, and it's organically grown outside, that could totally just ruin someone's harvest. So that's where I see the benefit for maintaining consistent quality. Doesn't necessarily have to be the top quality, but consistent quality that's safe to consume to live up to the supply and demand. So sure. The fact that you're experiencing low quality in Canada where they're growing indoors, that's where I can definitely agree that there's a major issue that I don't think is necessarily anything from organic to non-organic, but there's just a cultivation technique as well as quality control issues that are making the flower that's available to you not the best.
Well, I think what's happening, and again, you know, it's hard to get these numbers on in terms of what's getting returned and how much is qualifying for the system or what's failing. You know, in terms of legalization, we have it, yet there's very little transparency in the industry. And I've noted that many times in the past on other things. So what I kind of see that, you know, what would be nice to see, and I think you and I had this discussion in Prague, would be some sort of a rating systems outside of a lab test where we can actually really quantify the quality of the cannabis, which means the LPs would have to submit it to a third-party independent testing facility that just looks beyond lab results. So that's what I think is needed. Whether that happens or comes about, who knows? But the general feeling I'm getting from talking to people who have consumed and bought cannabis from the legal system is it's not there. They're still apt to go to their regular guy or girl or person wherever they get it. You know, you touched on a few things, and it's great to see that you have this background in becoming a chef. You use cannabis for your own medical needs, and now you're taking that acquired knowledge, applying it to really analyzing cannabis in terms of quality. You know, I think when you talk about the differences in beef, whether it's grass-fed or farm or industry beef or even tomatoes and stuff, you just know that something that's grown fresh from your own garden, your own organic soil or whatever, always seems to taste better. Like a tomato will taste better coming from an organic garden or your own garden versus something that's factory grown type of thing. And even though it could be greenhouses and all of that, there seems to be a difference. And I kind of think that's happening with cannabis, because I have a consultant that I use who helped me on my organics. And him and I have had great conversations over the last 6 months and talking about it. And he's a gentleman who's got Crohn's disease. So he actually grows his in such a way that he's building the microbial life, the probiotic in it. So he's tailoring his cannabis almost to help him with his Crohn's disease. And he's an old school grower. So these are things that I just don't think you can get in when you're starting to do stuff like, you know, soilless medium growth. Again, I'm not an expert in it, but I would almost think just something that you grow yourself and you're intimate with it in terms of knowing what was put into it and what it had gone through turns out to be a much better cannabis for yourself. And I'm happy that Canada, when they legalize cannabis and we have this corporate cannabis environment, they still have allowed every household to grow 4 plants for themselves. And I'm thankful for that, because I think that's it's a therapeutic benefit just to grow for yourself as well as, you know, the product that you come out with, and then doing everything else with the plant itself. I mean, I've grown, you know, now for the last 6 months, and, you know, when I'm trimming down a plant or trying to thin it out, I've got these beautiful fresh fan leaves or little leaves, especially the little ones. I just throw them in my vegetable salad and they taste great. There's benefits for it. So, and that's stuff you won't even get in the legal cannabis industry. Like, go try to buy, you know, fresh cut flowers or stuff and stuff like that. So I encourage everyone, really, if you can and have the means, grow it yourself. But if you have to go out and buy it and whatever, I still kind of, my gut tells me that organic is better, and I'd love to see more studies into it. That's for sure.
For sure. The first thing I'll respond to is our conversation where in Prague we were talking about how do you identify quality beyond the lab test, because the lab test is essentially chemotyping. It's telling you the chemical profile. And then, of course, there are some like states here in the U.S. where they require terpene tests. Some don't. But there are microbials and, you know, with like extract residual solvents and E. coli and different things that they test for. But one of the things that Trichome Institute created is a program called TAG, which is Trichome Assurance Grade. So for the listeners here, if you go to trichomeinstitute.com, you can read about our TAG program. This is the same program that we use when we judge the dope cannabis cups. We're the official judges for the dope cups, and we are the only judging team that actually has a standard operating procedure that is rating cannabis products based off of their quality, not based off of the strain name, not based off of the company that submitted it, or how fancy their packaging is. We do blind evaluations without having any of that information, so we're focusing strictly on the flower. So what we do with the TAG program is, of course, we have a lab test because we want to see, is it going to pass the pesticides? Is it going to pass microbials? We also want to be able to identify the terpenes that they say are present, the amount that are in them, the cannabinoids, things like that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's the physical and aromatic evaluation combined, which is based off of interpreting methodology, combined with the lab test that is what TAG is. So when I have a flower sample that I'm judging for one of these cannabis cups, or if I am just evaluating flower on my own, the first thing that I'm going to do is look at it aesthetically. I mean, does this flower look attractive? Does it look vibrant? Does it look like it was handled properly? How was it trimmed? Was it machine trimmed versus hand trimmed? Then I get up close with a jeweler's loop, you know, 10 to 20, even to 30X, to be able to identify the trichome density as well as the trichome ripeness. You know, are we looking at nothing but clear trichomes, or is there a nice mixture of vibrantly milky trichomes in there, or are they starting to amber a little bit? And that ratio of those different types is going to determine if it was harvested in the right amount of time. Is the flower structure on the broadleaf marijuana side of the spectrum or the narrowleaf marijuana spectrum based off of its density, its inflorescence structure, as well as the robustness or the petiteness of the pistils? And then from there, we actually break open the flower and we look deep in with a 300X Carson scope to identify if they're, again, looking at the trichomes, but this is where we're looking for insects, spider mite feces, eggs, exoskeletons. One of my favorites is I found a baby praying mantis exoskeleton in flower. We actually found living, kicking beetles, however a beetle got in flower, while judging a cup that someone spent $400 to submit a product in, and we found fine bugs and all these different things. And we find so many micro seeds, which is our hypothesis stems from the stressing of the mother plant for the cloning. And we also find a lot of mild to severe botrytis, which is a terrible systemic mold, all the way up to powdery mildew and different things like that. So this is something that we're doing for the judging of these dope cups, but it's also something that we ideally would like to implement into state or government, whether it be nationwide type of cannabis programs, because people need to understand that quality is not based off of the producer, the strain name, and the THC percentage. It goes well beyond that. Passing a lab test is obviously incredibly important, but there are so many things that a lab test does not test for, like trichome ripeness, or what type of bugs am I going to find in here, or was it dried and cured properly? Is there any jar rot? I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So TAG is a big part of that, which hopefully we'll be able to implement into other systems. Now, getting back to what you were saying more about the difference between, you know, commercial mass production versus locally grown organic and things like that, or doing it on your own, I totally agree. I think that even on a larger scale, you know, look at the cost of organic tomatoes 10 years ago versus today. So I hope that same type of trend happens in the cannabis industry, where the ability to grow organically with proper genetics that can handle these organic scenarios and not need all these pesticides and different things like that, that we'll be able to see that happen more in this space. I think it is going to take some time. I definitely encourage it. I think it's a better way to go. I mean, who wants unnecessary chemicals in something when it can grow perfectly fine on its own? But in the sense of talking about like growing your own, how, you know, it tastes better and the flavor's better, the experience is better, I think that I definitely encourage it. The natural skeptic in me, and also someone who's, you know, not necessarily grown cannabis on my own, but just had a tomato garden or has built something versus buying something, I think that there's this sense of, I don't know if we would call it placebo, or if it's just pride in general of doing something on your own, where if something is good, and considering you're your own worst critic, you know, if you have something that you would get from someone else, you would normally consider it good, but you did it on your own, now that good is great. Yeah. And what was great, now that great is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
There's like the sense of accomplishment and pride, which I think is amazing. And I think it's also, it's rewarding. You get, it's self-motivating. So I think if anyone has the opportunity to grow, you should. If you got a closet, you can turn into a space. I mean, you can make it happen with a light. But unfortunately, not everyone has that opportunity, so they are stuck. And for what I understand, you order through certain government-regulated programs in Canada. You're not able to actually go and, like, deli-style pick out your flower. Is that correct?
No, actually. So what's happened is initially in Ontario, where I'm from, they had the OCS store. It's the Ontario government store that was online. They just recently opened up this past month two dispensaries that are privately owned. Ironically, out of, I think there were 17,000 applications, a handful were awarded, and two only opened up on the deadline, one in Toronto, one in London, from what I understand. And the quality out of there is there. So here's the challenge that Canada has in terms of legal cannabis and buying it. So even if you get to a dispensary and you're allowed to buy from there, go, the packages are sealed. You can't open up the packages. So unless the dispensary may have a package opened up of that particular strain, I don't know, from, because I haven't gone to one just yet. I plan to go to one when I'm in Toronto at the end of the month, is probably when I'll go to the Toronto one, because I'll be speaking at the O Cannabis Conference. And it's something I actually wanted to talk to you about just on a follow-up. But again, that experience level is just not there if you're not able to smell and open up the jar and see what you're actually buying. So that's why the product is either people are disappointed and say, whatever, I'm not buying it from the government stores or the legal system again, or they get returns even. And I know the guys that set up the security for the industry, a company called 360 Secure, and they're the guy that helped put the deal together, him and I keep joking about what's happening with the legal system. And he goes, "Man, it doesn't matter. We're going to be shipping both ways. We're going to ship it to the customer, and then they're going to return it right back. We're going to ship it on the way back to the league." So it's kind of funny that we see it. I'd love to, at the end of the day, what you have done at the Trichome Institute with the TAG, is it TAG?
Yes, TAG, TAG.
Yeah. That is what I'd love to see to come to Canada. This is what I'm going to talk to you right at the end of this, towards the end of the show today. But I kind of want to get on to another topic that I'm focused on. I mentioned I'm speaking at the conference at the end of the month, the O'Cannabis, on Saturday, and I'll be talking about the topic is investment and business opportunities in a $1 trillion hemp industry. So hemp outdoors in Canada was only grown for the seeds, hemp heart seeds. Last year, we started hearing the rumors about using flowers for CBD. So I started my hemp farm project. The problem is Canada doesn't have the right cultivar to make it economical to grow hemp. The best we could probably get is about 2%. There is one cultivar that's under R&D. I know the gentleman who's got the license to do it. I'm going to speak to him at the conference to see if I can get a licensed facility. It makes it more economical. But it kind of goes back to now this whole thing of you're going to get a lab test from the hemp flower to get the CBD, but where is this farm? Is it? Are you taking something that's been growing corn or canola or some pesticide Monsanto ag business farm, and now you're going to convert that to cannabis? Well, all that pesticide stuff that's in the land is going to get soaked up into the flower, and inevitably it expresses itself in the flower itself. So now we've got to go back to, well, do we go back to untouched virgin land or organic land and grow organic hemp for CBD? That's the way I believe it should go, but these are things I'm exploring. But the challenges of just being able to grow on scale and be able to process this at the end of the season to be able to do it, I think people are really underestimating the logistics and the processing capacity. But I'm also looking at the industrial hemp industry, and that's going to be another topic, not something we can discuss here. But from your experience, and you've touched on it already a little bit, growing cannabis or hemp outdoors is challenging in itself with all of the environmental conditions. My thought is, if we're going to grow hemp outdoors for CBD, there almost has to be some sort of I don't like to call regulatory or governing body because I'm a free market type of a guy, but an organization that will be able to independently third party go out to the farms, vet the soil, vet the conditions, and then continually test maybe a couple of times throughout the season, as well as go there when they're cropping out to identify it. Because the last thing you don't want to see happen is a farm that spent hundreds of thousands, if not more, to grow a big crop, had some issue, and then tries to still push it in through the system because they're saying it's only going down to isolate form. And when I see CBD isolate and I hear about how it comes about, people generally stay away from CBD that's coming out of China, because even though they grow a lot of hemp for industrial, they're doing it on questionable land. So that's one of the big issues with CBD from China. Now, I know the U.S. has been growing CBD and Europe is big on it. And that's when I realized several years ago, CBD is going to be a huge industry, when I first spoke at Prague. And then came back and saw what Canada was doing for the CBD market, and it's nothing. And even today, so we were going to fall behind on the CBD market. In Canada, we are already behind. We may be at the forefront of legalization and having a commercial cannabis industry for recreational medical, but we've fallen behind on the CBD. So I guess from your experiences, your knowledge, your expertise, do you have any ideas, suggestions, things that we can kind of discuss for outdoor farming for hemp, primarily for the CBD?
So within my expertise on cannabis, a lot of my focus is post-cure. So it's the flower post-production and identifying the quality and everything from there. Also focusing on more of the science and medicinal side. I am not a cultivator, nor do I claim to be any type of expert in the sense of the indoor or outdoor farming practices for cannabis as a whole, marijuana or hemp, or however you would like to name the various types that we consume.
Sure.
With that being said, I'm also someone who is definitely pro-clean, pro-organic, sustainable practices and all these different things. So, I look at some of the things you brought up here, like, isolate versus full spectrum. something coming from Europe or something coming from China versus something in the United States or Jamaica or Canada. And the possible toxicity issues or impurity issues that may be involved. And I think ultimately the first thing that someone has to identify when we're talking about CBD would be the dose and the efficacy. And then they have to look at how they're consuming it. Okay. So first thing, let's look at dose. Regardless of whether you're working with isolate or full spectrum CBD that's derived from hemp that has 0.3% THC or less, if you look at any mammal or any human study on CBD, you will find that the average dosing is between 5 to 25 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. Now, I am 6 foot. I'm about 185 pounds, so that's somewhere right around, like, let's just say 85 kilograms. So 85 times 5, that would be a 425 milligram dose as a bare bone minimum for efficacy for someone my size. Now, the lowest dose on CBD,
and that's per day, is that correct?
That's per day.
Okay.
And that's on the low end. So now I'm multiply that by 5, so 5 to 25. So that's between 400 and 2100 milligrams of CBD a day, okay, for someone my size, 6 foot, about 185 pounds, roughly 85 kilograms, okay? So now, right now, in any CBD company that's doing CBD only from hemp or regardless, as long as there's less than 0.3% THC, you're going to hear people that are telling you to take anywhere from 5 to 25 milligrams total a day. Doesn't matter about your weight. Doesn't matter about your medical history. They don't get into any other drugs that you're on because of the interference that CBD can have with cytochrome P450 enzyme, which is a drug metabolizing enzyme. They don't care. They just say, hey, take your dose CBD, whatever your issue is, anxiety, depression, epilepsy, cancer, this, they just list it all and they say you're going to be good to go. It's like it's snake oil, miracle molecule type of sales pitch. And it, quite frankly, drives me crazy because what they do is they take all of the conclusions from these studies and they say that CBD has been found to show benefits or efficacy in dealing with these symptoms or these diseases. And they list all of those, but they don't talk about the middle of the research, which is where they show the dosing or they show the subject that's being studied, whether it be a mouse, a rat, or a human, or anything else in between. And when it comes to an in vitro study, so a test tube or petri dish study, I don't even look at them anymore because it means nothing in the sense of what will actually happen biologically, physiologically within a living or an in vivo study, mammal of sorts, or a human being. So that's the first thing you got to look at is the dose. Now, if someone's consuming THC at the same time, the entourage of CBD and THC minimizes the necessary amount of CBD. For example, if you look at Sativex by GW Pharmaceuticals, which is a naturally cannabis-derived prescription, it's available in, I think, over 32 different countries, I believe, at this point. Sativex is approximately a 1-to-1 ratio of CBD and THC at around 2.5 milligrams each. I think it's 2.5 and 2.7. I just can't remember exactly which, but let's just say it's a 1-to-1 of 2.5 milligrams of each. So you have 2.5 milligrams of each CBD and THC together, 5 milligrams total of cannabinoids, and one pill shows efficacy. It shows that they can measure that it's actually doing something. On the flip side, you have Epidiolex, which is by the same company, GW Pharmaceuticals, which was just legalized here in the United States and is now FDA approved. The average dose for Epidiolex, which is CBD isolate, is between 10 and 20 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. Now, that's for seizures versus Sativex, which is for a much larger list of things. But still, that dose is so astronomically different. 2.5 milligrams to 2.5 milligrams on one side, and then you have 10 to 20 milligrams per kilogram of body weight on the other. So And the reason I bring this up, like I said, dosing is the first thing that people need to understand. Now, the difference between isolate and full spectrum, you will find studies that show that full spectrum is more effective and you can have a lower dose to achieve greater results. But still, the dosing is around 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram of body weight versus isolate, which is generally on the higher end, upward in the 20 plus milligrams per kilogram of body weight.
Wow.
So even with today's market of 0.3% full spectrum THC oil, however many milligrams are in the bottle, chances are, if you're not consuming closer ratios of THC, then you're going to have to drink that entire bottle of CBD oil at a time. So now, that's the dosing. And then the next thing I mentioned was how it's consumed. So if you have a full spectrum cannabis oil that is in a vape pen that you're consuming, it's going to be more effective than an oil, okay? Because you would actually digest, because it's a different consumption method, okay? And the bioavailability of these compounds is different, and they're being metabolized a little bit different as well. You know, you still have cytochrome P450 enzymes in your lungs as well as in your liver, but it increases bioavailability, therefore it may increase the efficacy. So that's on the vape pen side, which if you want to get the most bang for your buck, that's what I would personally, not being a doctor or a medical professional, I can't obviously diagnose or prescribe or tell people what to do. But in my opinion, I would always say to go that route if you're looking for the most bang for your buck. But now let's take in the consideration of impurities. So if you have impurities that are being leached out of the ground, because that's what hemp loves to do, it loves to pull things out of the ground. And what is it? I think they used it in various chemical spills. I think there was something about a recent radiation with one of the, was it in Japan or even in Chernobyl or something, where they're using hemp to clean the ground. That's amazing. But
well, that's what I heard was
that.
Yeah, like the Russian nuclear disaster at Chernobyl. I heard they planted hemp in and around it, all around it, just to soak up all the radiational materials. And so it's a great product for a lot of things. But please go on.
Exactly.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yep. No, so but that's like one of the things that we know that hemp does. Obviously, if you're going to take a plant and you're going to put it, and by hemp I mean marijuana as well. It's not just hemp. It is the, you know, the high CBD to the high THC and the various species. You know, technically hemp is cannabis sativa, and what we actually call sativa is truly cannabis indica subspecies indica, and what we call indica is really cannabis indica subspecies afghanica, and then we have the chinensis, which is the broadleaf style hemp in the indica species, and that's a whole quagmire that we kind of unravel in the interpreting program, which is online if you're curious about that. But anyway, so getting back to your consumption method. So we talked about dose being effective. We talked about isolate versus full spectrum and the difference in efficacy. And the other thing I'll mention about isolate versus full spectrum is studies have shown that isolate has something called the bell curve response curve, which basically means that, you know, let's say a 5 milligrams per kilogram isolate is ineffective. At 10, it's ineffective. But you get to like 25 milligrams per kilogram, it is effective. But then what happens is when you take more, it becomes ineffective again. So at 50 or 75 milligrams per kilogram, it actually starts to go downward in its efficacy. So it creates this bell type of curve that if you were to look at a graph, whereas the full spectrum is a constant increase. So the more you take, the more effective it is. So that's one of the other things that's different between isolate and full spectrum. Now, going to the consumption method, like I said, the vaporization of it, the inhalation of it, is going to have a higher bioavailability, most likely get more bang for your buck. But now let's talk about the toxins and the impurities. I would much rather digest something with toxins in it than inhale it.
Really? Yeah, okay.
So think about your stomach acid, that entire environment, all the bacteria in your gut, your detox pathways with your liver and kidneys and all these different things. And I'm not the biologist or, you know, doctor to be able to identify all those pathways, but I would honestly much rather eat something that is not the purest versus than inhaling it. Now, that means inhaling the extract, depending on how purified it is or distilled or whatnot, as well as just smoking flower. So I think that if there's people out there that are genuinely concerned about impurities within their cannabis, the first thing that they're going to have to do is look at all the other impurities that you consume on a regular basis that you may just overlook, you know, especially when it comes to food and it comes to bad habits. So let's just start there. So if you're not concerned with that, but you're concerned with your cannabis, like, it doesn't make sense. So if you're truly concerned about all impurities you're consuming in your lifestyle, and cannabis is a part of that, personally, I would much rather digest something that may have impurities in it rather than the inhalation, just because of how the stomach and everything. But when you do that, you're minimizing your bioavailability, and you're also going to have different effects because consumption determines function. That's like my whole MO. Sure. So the effects you get from inhaling something that has terpenes and minor cannabinoids present is going to be totally different than the digestion, because the digestion of terpenes is not the same as the inhalation of terpenes as well.
So there's an actual different effect?
Say that again?
So there's an actual different effect vaping cannabis with terpenes versus ingesting cannabis that has terpenes. And I also want you to touch on, we had this conversation in Prague, the relationship between terpenes and THC, because a lot of people are focused on THC and how one interacts with the other. And we had this conversation, but I'm going to let you talk about it.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the entourage effect. And one of the biggest misconceptions about cannabis is that, and specifically, let's say on the marijuana side, so through Trichome Institute, we've separated, you know, everyone calls it cannabis. Well, there's cannabis, but there's hemp. And then there's the other side. And I, you know, a lot of people don't like calling it a drug. So like Robert Clark and Mark Merlin and some of the others, so which we have immense amount of respect for and helped inspire the interpreting program and methodology. But we separate as hemp and marijuana. And believe it or not, there's a much larger history behind the word marijuana, which we have a video on within our Trichome Institute's Facebook, which you can check out, with a professor in Southwest Studies who focuses on ancient medicinal plants. He discusses the true history of the word marijuana and stemming back nearly 500 years ago to the Spaniards that came over and occupied what is now Latin America, and how this work came to be that was kind of inspired and created out of their own prohibition against indigenous people. And it's a quite fascinating story. So if anyone listening to hears may be triggered by hearing that word marijuana in the sense of what we know of it from the 1930s being this not so great of a word in which it was used, there's much more to it. So I would encourage you to check out that video. But so we have cannabis is the genus, and then we have, you know, all these subspecies and different things, but they're all so interbred and whatnot. That's why we just separate as there's broad to narrow leaf hemp and broad to narrow leaf marijuana.
Right.
So when it comes to consuming marijuana, one of the biggest misconceptions is that THC determines potency. And that is so far from the truth. Because you can get flower with a 10% THC profile that has an enormous amount of pungent terpenes, and you will feel higher than you will with a 35% flower that's nothing but THC and there's hardly any terpenes whatsoever. When actually one of my favorite examples is, it was, I believe, the Seattle Dope Cup that we judged. That was actually my first Dope Cup that I judged with Trichome Institute. We weren't looking for this, but what we did is we went through and we looked at all of our reports on all the, I think there was something over 180 different flower samples, I believe. The highest rated flower that had the highest score, regardless of any of the categories, was 14% THC. And the reason why is when I opened it up out of the container, I remember judging it, I got smacked in the face with terpenes. They were so pungent. And the pungency is what determines the potency when combined with the cannabinoids. So THC doesn't determine potency. It's the entourage of the cannabinoids and the terpenes that truly provokes its efficacy. Now, the reason that terpenes through digestion are totally different is because you guys eat terpenes all the time. Every time you pretty much eat a salad or have some type of plant, you are eating terpenes.
Right,
okay? But what happens is when you are inhaling terpenes, they are metabolized one way and they act on various systems outside of the endocannabinoid system, okay? So terpenes do not affect CB1 and CB2 receptors like cannabinoids do outside of beta-caryophyllene, which is a CB2 agonist, okay, at the right dose, which is important. So when you're looking at terpenes, they work on different systems or different receptors, like neurotransmitters and hormones, or monoamines, as they're referred to, like acetylcholine and serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine and different things like that. So when you're inhaling these terpenes with cannabinoids, it's not just your CB receptors, your endocannabinoid system that's being activated or modulated. You have hormones and neurotransmitters and other receptors like PPAR, peroxisome, proliferator activated receptors. You have TRP receptors, which are pain receptors. And there's other G protein coupled receptors, which are the same type of receptors that CB receptors are, that cannabinoids and different terpenes, mainly the cannabinoids can modulate and activate. So when you inhale it, that's one thing. Now, when you digest it, just like I was explaining before, where your stomach alters things and your liver, the way you metabolize things are different, it's the same thing applies for terpenes. You know, when you smoke THC, the primary metabolite that is affecting you is delta-9 THC with a very small amount of 11-hydroxy-THC. When you eat an edible, more of that delta-9 gets converted by your liver and is transformed into 11-hydroxy. So it increases the 11-hydroxy, which is why the high is totally different. The effects are different. It takes a while for it to kick in, so forth and so on. So when I heard about edibles and terpenes, I was a little skeptical because I noticed that it doesn't matter what type of edible I did, the effects were all very similar. So I started researching about the digestion and the metabolism of terpenes. And what I found is that not only does your stomach, and there's research to back this where they were looking at extracts from Humulus lupulus, hops, you know, what we put in beer, what makes an IPA bitter. And there's something called picker's fatigue, I believe they call it, hops fatigue, which is where people picking hops, they get very fatigued and sedative and relaxed, and they wanted to see like what was causing this. And so there was a study that was done where they created a stomach environment with the same pH and different acids and blah blah blah, and they put this terpene profile from hops into this solution, and the terpene, say linalool for example, was then transformed into several other different terpenes. Okay, so linalool maintained some of its structure, but then also turned into like neryl and or terpinol and like in different terpenes, and then it goes into the liver, and the liver then changes each of those into different derivatives. Okay, so, and I'm just throwing random numbers here, but right, just to give the example,
but I'm gonna
linalool is your first, let's say linalool now becomes one becomes five, and then each one of those now becomes two or three or four or something different. So now that one terpene that you digest, by the time it actually gets through your liver, could be upwards of, you know, a dozen or 20 or more different derivatives of that. So now what you have to look at is that is a completely chemically different molecule than what linalool is.
Okay? So what you're saying is the terpene profiles almost get changed while it's being digested in through your system.
And they don't almost get changed. They do get changed.
Okay, sorry, Brandon, but we only have a couple of minutes left, so I'm almost trying to get this wrapped up because there's a few other things I want to discuss, but it's a very interesting conversation, and I hope you decide to come back again with us in the future and continue that conversation on the value of the terpenes and how it gets digested and cooking with it, because that's where I see a lot of expertise from you coming out of, so...
Sure. And just to wrap up this subject, the last thing I'll say is when you have these different derivatives and these different compounds from the original terpene, by the time it is systemic and is able to be in the bloodstream, which one of those derivatives or those metabolites can affect, say, GABA or dopamine or anything like that? And do you have enough of a dose?
Right.
So that's why in the sense of eating an edible, the difference between an indica edible and a sativa edible is you saw that it says sativa, and that placebo of it being sativa is what makes it more uplifting, not the terpene profile.
So it's a placebo. Interesting. There's always great conversations with you. I love them. and I always learn something. And I say that, you know, with a bit of respect, because I talk to lots of people in the industry and they start going off on all this stuff. And especially the best one I always hear is a company that's looking to get set up and do cultivation. Oh, we have the best master grower. Next. I mean, like, but we do only have a couple of minutes. So I want to thank you for coming out. I also want to invite you to the KW Toronto area at the end of October. So for people who may not know yet, I'm actually planning a festival at the end of October. And I'd love for you to come out. Maybe even if we turn it into more than just a big festival, maybe do a couple of workshops leading up into it. I'd love to have you come out and do a workshop on the tag and terpenes and stuff like that, if you're available. But
we have our interpreting program that we recently filmed, and we have online through trackhominstitute.com. But we also do teach the live level one interpreting course in person. So that's something, it'd be great. It's about a 5.5 hour presentation and followed by an exam. So maybe that's something we can set up, is to get up in the Toronto area there and teach a course and have some open Q&A and maybe some other workshops that are associated with it. We'd love to do that.
Definitely. We don't even need to wait till October. If it makes sense and there's interest, we'll organize it earlier, and I'll help you get it all figured out. But we only got about 2 minutes left. So, Brandon, is there anything else that you want to share, what you're doing, you know, what your plans are in the future, in the space, that sort of thing? Also, maybe how people can contact you if they want to. That's if you want to get that out.
Yeah, for sure. So everything I go by is Chef Brandon Allen. So on Instagram, which is where I post a lot of educational resources and studies and quick little 1 minute long educational clips. So at Chef Brandon Allen, BrandonAllen. You can look me up on YouTube. And as far as the things that I'm working on, gosh, we would have to have a whole other call.
We're going to run out of a minute. So we will, we're going to definitely follow up sometime. I hope definitely look at bringing Tag here and other things. It was a pleasure having you on, and I look forward to talking with you again. And thank you for joining us. This is Vin Maru on the Talking Cannabis Radio Show on